Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure always to work with Ruth, and she's really part of our team at CDC that's helping to develop some of these tools. And I'm going to go over a lot of the same ground that Ruth has gone over, but I'm going to do it with a particular focus, and that focus is on Mills Harm Principle. And after I had already created my slides and sent them in, we had a meeting of what's called the LAWSAC group at CDC, and that's the Law Scientific Advisory Group. And this particular session was from a couple of legal academics, as they called themselves, and they had started to form a network. And they had started to form this network because they were concerned, and they were hearing a lot of concerns that from lawyers and from public health folks, that a primary tool of public health, the ability to use law to assist public health, was becoming increasingly difficult. That, you know, it was like the climate, the political climate, the climate of social norms that was out there was making it very difficult for public health to use one of the tools that's always been one of its staples. And so they wanted to, we talked about collaborating with them because we think this is a real problem. And that we talked about the gap. One way of looking at that gap is friction. And for whatever reason in the current political climate, in the norm climate, that friction is very high. And so what we see ourselves as doing is in some ways trying to reduce that friction. So what I'm going to talk about is some way to characterize what I think is the one of the major sources of that friction, and something that helps to explain this shift in climate that is making the, using the tools of law more difficult. And I'm going to do that with respect to talking about Mills Harm Principle in relationship to something I'm sure you're familiar with, that, you know, Jacobson versus Massachusetts, which was really the sort of legal precedent on the basis of which a lot of public health law has been based. And so I'm just trying to make us aware that this tectonic plate shift has occurred in the way we're doing things. And by becoming aware of that, you know, maybe we can in some ways address some of the problems. Okay. That's just from my abstract. Let's get to the cut to the chase. So this is Mill's Harm Principle, and I'll just read it. The only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of a civilized community against his will is to prevent harm to others. His own good, either physical or moral, is not sufficient warrant. So what this basically means is then the state can intervene to protect public health when an individual action threatens to harm others, but the state cannot compel you to do something for your own good if you are not harming others. And that, you know, that's what we talked about before with the nanny state. What you do behind closed doors, what you do on your own, if it's not affecting anyone else, then the state has no right to intervene. Now, this has, I don't think, any legal status. This is just an ethical principle. But what I'm claiming is that this principle has become, in effect, the way, part of what I'm calling the social climate or social norm that seems to be operating. So another way of saying that is that for this harm principle, liberty is the default condition. And there's only one exception to that, and that is if you're harming someone else. And so this is the more traditional basis of public health law, and that's the Jacobson versus Massachusetts framework. Now, let me just ask, are you all familiar with that, or do I need? No. Okay, well, Jacobson was someone who, this goes back to the time when, I guess it was around the early 1904, Jacobson was someone who refused to get vaccinated. He was given a $5 fine for not wanting to be vaccinated. And this was against smallpox. And this is when smallpox was still the scourge of mankind, and a lot of outbreaks occurred in the U.S. But he sued. And so there was actually a whole series of state laws and state challenges to the public health authority that eventually worked their way up to the federal level, and then it issued in this ruling of Jacobson versus Massachusetts. And They ruled that the ruling was that if there's a public health necessity, in this case the harm that could result to others from being infected by smallpox, if there is a public health necessity, then the state has the authority, has the police powers to restrict liberty. So that was the basic ideas, and they had to use reasonable means. It had to be proportional. The burden had to be in some ways commensurate with the anticipated benefit. You couldn't harm someone in trying to do that. You know, for example, we know that someone is immunocompromised today, we have exceptions to mandatory vaccine requirements. So that whole idea of exceptions based on, say, immunocompromised status is something that's fully within this framework of Jacobson versus Massachusetts. And then procedural limits are going to take place. We worked on something called the Do Not Board Order, and they can restrict you from flying, but because you might endanger people on the plane. But they also have a procedure for getting you off as quickly as possible. So there's limits placed on this. So basically, I would put it this way: that for Jacobson versus Massachusetts, the right of the state to intervene is the default. But then you can carve out, then you have carved out in the direction of liberty certain restrictions on that. Whereas from Mill, from the perspective of Mill, liberty is the default. So it really is quite a different. I thought this through in logical terms, and it turns out that my conclusion was that for Jacobson, that harm is a sufficient, what in logic is called a sufficient principle. In other words, the existence of harm provides sufficient warrant to restrict liberty, whereas for Mill, it's what we call a necessary condition, or a condition without which, a negative condition. If you're not harming someone else, then you cannot restrict liberty. And so that way of looking at it places a higher bar, a higher hurdle for any law to get over in the case of Mill. It's in some ways more restrictive. So what I'm arguing is that in a way explains part of the current climate, that even though this isn't an official position of anybody, this is what has crept up as kind of the social norm. And so we have a high hurdle there. And so one way to understand this is part of a more general climate of libertarian thought in this country. And, libertarianism is an aspect of liberalism, and the liberal in this very broad sense of, political democracy has two different aspects to it. One is where social utility trumps rights. An example of that would be utilitarianism, where you think about the greatest good for the greatest number, or the welfare state is an aspect of liberalism, where you have a more collective thinking. But there's also a very opposite kind of thinking in liberalism, where rights trump social utility. Individual rights, contract rights, property rights take precedent. And libertarianism is one aspect of that. And, as a general definition, is this idea that liberty is the default, and that, you don't want much government interference in the lives of private individuals. And in the United States, I think there's three aspects to this kind of libertarianism. And one is, I think, enunciated by that Mill's harm principle that we just saw. Another is something that we know from American history, rugged individualism. When I was a little, this dates me, but when I was a little kid, I had one of those Davy Crockett hats. Davy Crockett was on TV. I remember it got so ratty that my parents kept telling me I got to get rid of it, but I wouldn't get rid of it, and so they just took it one year and disposed of it. It's probably a health hazard. Try to give me one of those cockpit, those leather cockpit things, but I never got over it. So this is in a way I'm trying to. But anyway, the story I wanted to get to was that with Davy Crockett, I remember a story reading. I read, a biography of Davy Crockett. One thing I remember from the story was Davy Crockett. I think he was from Kentucky now, but he, liked to hunt. And I remember reading some story that some other settlers moved within 50 miles of him. And Davy said, "Well, it's getting a little too crowded here. I'm going to have to move out where I can have complete freedom," And so we have this tradition in America of the frontier, the rugged individualist, and nobody tells him what to do. You can still see certain areas of your city, maybe, that are in a hollow where everyone drives a pickup truck. And they don't want, you know, they don't want anyone to tell them what they're doing. So we have this strong tradition, which in a way doesn't make sense anymore because we all live, most of us live in cities now. And then finally, the other aspect is this Cold War opposition to collective decision making. That we were in a war with the Soviet Union, and so collectivist decisions were bad. Hayek's The Road to Serfdom, anything that smacks of government intervention and socialism is a move towards serfdom. And so you combine all these three elements, and I think they've coalesced now to create this climate that big government is bad, paternalism is bad, you can't restrict liberty. And so Nancy Cass was one of the early pioneers in public health ethics, and so she tried to, in some ways, oh no. She tried to strike this balance between the mandate of public health and individual liberty. And so she actually refers to her position as a code of restraint. When public health has to restrict liberty, how can they do that in such a restrained way? And so she came up with these ways of looking at it. You have to ask, what are the goals? How effective does the program realize these goals? What are the potential burdens? Are alternatives available to reduce burdens? You know, if you can find some other way that's less restrictive, or you find the least restrictive way, then that's a better way. So those are just some, like a checklist of ideas that you could think through to ensure that, you know, when you have to intervene, you do so in the way that, won't rock the boat, won't rock the libertarian boat in this country. Now, we've already talked about tobacco, and I think it's a very illustrative example of sort of like one of those 3D pictures. You look at it one way, it's one thing, you look at it another. In the case of tobacco, when we, for a very long time, we knew that it had very harmful effects. But if you just think about it, the legislation seemed like it never could get started. Enormous amount of work, and study after study after study, and almost nothing happened. And then all of a sudden, when we came up with this idea, or when the research showed that secondary smoke caused harm to others, then it seemed like the avalanche of regulation occurred. Now, that's a primary illustration of this Mills principle. You know, when you're not harming anyone else, the state has no right to intervene. But once we had that harm other, then it was like a switch was flipped, and then the legislation happened. And that's very insightful because it sort of illustrates how people are thinking. And so that's, I think, what is going on here. And the other point I want to make is, and this is actually a positive thing, now we're talking about things like banning smoking outdoors, banning smoking in parks and so on. And it seems like, a lot of people are talking, well, we don't really have the evidence to show that, outdoor smoking really adversely affects others. But what's happening is there are other kind of ideas that are coming along. You know, this is a bad example for children, or it's harming the environment. So we're seeming like as this legislation has developed a certain momentum, it seems like then also people are willing to think outside the Millian context in these particular instances. So if we could mimic that somehow, say with obesity, and get over this, what I'm calling the Millian hurdle, then other things also might be possible. Now, in the case of obesity, now again, your immediate thought is, if I'm sitting in my house being a couch potato, becoming obese, who am I hurting? I'm not directly hurting someone else physically in the same way I would if I'm smoking. And so because of that, we can't invoke the Mills principle here to be able to pass legislation. So the hurdle is still very high. And I think that's part of what's going on. And we've seen in the case of soda taxes, or Mayor Bloomberg only wanted to limit portion size. He was immediately charged with, this is the beginning of the nanny state. What are they going to do next? And so in these cases, the Mills harm principle is a high hurdle, and it seems to be working against things. And then, again, as part of our analytical tools, we want to think how this is similar and how this is different from tobacco. So children are a vulnerable group, and as a vulnerable group, their liberty has to be protected by parents. So we're not dealing with fully autonomous person, so that gives us some inroads, just as it did for, we were able to ban smoking for children even prior to this knowledge of secondary smoke. So the other thing is that eating is a necessity, but that's going to make it that could make it easier to ban too. Well, I'm take that back. That actually works against you in some way, or maybe it could work both ways, yeah. In classical capitalist theory, Adam Smith said there are certain things that you can easily tax, and that is if there's a lot of use and they're a luxury, and in this case of tobacco and alcohol, kind of a vice, then it's easy to tax stuff like that. So, Mamilian context is balancing individual liberty and communal good. That's a basic thing. But we're asking, what should take precedent here? That we're even asking that question is sort of moving beyond that. And so we're also asking, what situations would justify limiting individual liberty, even when it does not directly physically harm others? So we want to think about, how can you do that? How can you get over that harm? And I'm just going to throw out some of these suggestions. What do we got here? 3 minutes? 4 minutes? 4.5? Okay, I'll do this quickly. Some of these people we've been working with, others just published on this. One is to come up with a taxonomy of harms instead of just direct harms. You can think of indirect harms. How is this affecting the healthcare system? How much is this costing, for example? And then Madison and Powers, Madison Powers has recently come up with a new understanding of Mill, who has argued that when Mill invoked this principle, he just didn't mean any kind of freedom. He meant serious. He meant it in the full sense of autonomy. When you're making a decision that in some ways is crucial to defining who you are as a person and your life choice and your career, that's the kind of restriction of freedom that we do not want in a democracy. But this can't, just not any, anything, whether I want to jaywalk or not. These are serious things. And so you might say that he is sort of, Madison Powers has sort of lowered the hurdle by only talking about freedoms that are important freedoms and not just anything you do. Then the next one is Angus Dawson, and he has tried to just say, let's stop talking about all autonomy all the time. It's not as though there aren't other values that we can invoke here in these situations. The harm that's being done to our children. So there's a sort of a rule in logic and argumentation that you don't want to try to fight out battles on someone else's turf. So stop talking about autonomy all the time. Start talking more. Every time they tell you about this is restricting liberty, you just come back with, this is harming our children. What about that? And just try to get the argument framed on your terms. And then finally, Bruce Jennings has a relational notion of autonomy that what we mean by society is it's not just a mere aggregate of individuals, it's a collective, and so that collective action is a realization of our autonomy. And I'm going to sort of add to that by saying that autonomy is different from natural liberty. It's not the Davy Crockett liberty, that really autonomy is about building a society. And by creating these restrictions, mutually agreed restrictions, that's what civilization is about. It's not about, being Davy Crockett out in the wilderness. And I want to, that's actually a quote from Hobbes who says the last thing. He says, regulations are not shackles, but they're more like hedgerows that should keep us properly flowing along in the social traffic. And think of regulations not as shackles, but as in the manner of a traffic light. If we all had complete natural freedom, when we're coming into an intersection, let's say like Market and 4th here in San Francisco at rush hour, if everyone simply, you know, there were no traffic lights there, what would happen? You would end up with a complete traffic jam. You would not have any realization of your freedom. You'd end up neutralizing each other. And it's by creating these restrictions, as little as possible, that we actually create real freedom. That we get, you know, but that's civic freedom. That's not this natural Davy Crockett freedom. And so I'm saying that last remark in terms of trying to make a larger argument against this whole social norm and climate of thinking that government intervention is bad. Okay, I'm going to stop here, and thank you very much.